The year is 1989, and we follow the friendship between a curious orange tabby cat, Milo, and playful pug puppy, Otis. Set against our gentle rural landscape, the story traces their separation and parallel journeys as they face rivers, forests, wildlife, and the challenges of growing up. While relying on simple storytelling, expressive animal behavior, and a calm narration by comedian Dudley Moore, the film is warm and comforting, emphasizing loyalty, courage, and the bond between different species. For many viewers, the movie evokes nostalgia, a happy memory of childhood. Yet as adults, we can't help but recognize the dullness of the narrative. Now, over the years, the film has sparked discussion about animal welfare standards in older productions, which shapes how modern audiences may view it today. But despite this, this film remains memorable for its wholesome spirit and its celebration of friendship and perseverance across generations worldwide. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover the adventures of Milo and Otis. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Okay, so, like, I think this might have been, like, required viewing for kids born in the 80s. It came out in 1989. I was 8 when it came out. I was already kind of past the cute animal movie phase when it hit theaters. I remember the commercials. I was watching Masters of the Universe and G.I. Joe and Ninja Turtles. I was in that zone. But in elementary school or daycare, this was kind of like standard viewing when they wheeled the cart out and put a movie in for the kids to fall asleep to. So I have seen this on multiple occasions as a child. I just never really had a strong emotional bond to it, but also I didn't hate it. Like, oh, please not Milo and Otis again. It's cute. It's harmless. So not having seen it in, what, 30-something years, having never shown it to my two children, I was wondering how I would respond to it as an adult. And here's my point of view of it. I remembered the music. When the song came on, the opening song over the credits, I was like, I can remember this song. I remember the jauntiness of it. And then I also remembered it is just a visual storybook told by Dudley Moore, which I don't hate, but at the same time, it's hard to be entertained by that. As an adult, it is like watching an extended YouTube video of some guy just chirping over the action on the screen, not to mention the fact that we're seeing animals in peril, which I don't think we associated the real peril of animal welfare in a production like this when we were kids. So all in all, my revisit of Milo and Otis, it was cute, it was nostalgic. I tore it apart in my mind of like, how many cats drown in that river scene, but I tried to not let that flood the waters of my mind. All in all, I think I gave it 2.5 stars. I didn't hate it, but the nostalgia, the warmth of other movies that we've watched on the show, it just wasn't there for me. How about you?
You know, I think when you brought this to the table, I thought to myself, this is really going to put our conversation muscles to the test if we can stretch Milo and Otis to a normal runtime on this episode. But, you know,
it's not even a normal runtime movie. It's an hour and 15 minutes.
But you know what? I think we can do it. But I'm with you. And during my rewatch, I agree. And I'm glad you brought it up. The ending song. I'm like, oh, now I remember, and it's the same with me. Right. It's been about 30 years, and now I get it. Now I understand why teachers wheeled this movie into the classroom, because you know what? By the halfway mark, kids that are hyperactive are going to be tired, they're going to be sleepy, and they'll either be so bored to the extent that they don't have to explain where all the kittens and puppies came from towards the ending climax. So I think this is a perfect, almost hypnotic movie to just kind of relax. And I got to tell you, during my rewatch, and again, I haven't seen it in 30 plus years, I was struggling staying awake because it is a lullaby.
Dude, me too. It's an hour and 15 minutes. It's quite possibly the shortest film that we've reviewed in the 2 years we've been doing this show. And I nodded off like three times. And I was like watching it in the middle of the day in my office on a laptop. And I was just like, whoa, I got to pull myself back together.
I got to the point where I said, I need to take a break. I stood up and I'm trying to do chores. And I'm like, I am so tired right now, but I'm going to go back. But at the same time, I don't hate it, but that's part of the nostalgia of it, right? It's like, if I watched this as a first time view, I would have probably hated it. I probably would have said It's innocent, it's cutesy, it has its moments of watching YouTube videos of kittens and puppies, but nothing really happens. These dogs, this cat, go through animal versus situation versus animal versus situation, and it's just a slideshow to entertain kids. And that's the innocence of it, is just to entertain kids. So for just that, I can appreciate it. I don't appreciate the backstory. If that was, again, released now, it would have been hated. And I'm sure we're going to get into a lot of the background of this movie, but it's an innocent movie for the time without any of the background knowledge that we have of this film.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really, what it made me do is it made me kind of go back and think about the animal slash nature films that were so popular of the 80s, Benji the Hunted, which we haven't necessarily covered the whole movie. We covered the Benji versus Full Metal Jacket episode at the start of season two. So we kind of touched on it a little bit. We have Far From Home on our list. So we've got other animal movies of the 80s and 90s on the list. But I was thinking about the Disney movies of the 60s and 70s, like the original Incredible Journey or Charlie the Lonesome Cougar. Like, they had all these movies with an animal hero in peril, and it made me think about it. It's like, what was the welfare state of these animals in peril, right? Where it's like, you're telling a narrative with a narrator about, like, this cougar or this wolf, or there's one about a seal. I really remember that one. And, like, they fall off cliffs and they roll down hills. It's like, they didn't do that on their own. Animals don't act. They were pushed down the hill. They were coaxed to go near a cliff, right? So now I have to go back and reevaluate how I feel about all these animal movies. And so here's the thing with this one. Let's give some quick stats on it. So for one, this is, I never knew this until a few years ago. This is actually an American slash English redub of a Japanese film called The Adventures of Chatran. Chatran being the cat, and Pusky being the original name for Otis, the dog. Released in 1986, it was the third highest grossing Japanese film of all time up to that point. Like, people loved this movie in Japan, which is why it got prompted to get re-edited and Americanized for our audiences. What blew my mind is that it took 4 years to shoot that and edit it, and they had over 74 hours of footage, roughly 400,000 feet of film, to make an hour and 15-minute-long movie about this cat and this dog. And as you can tell from the movie, they are put in peril. They are thrown in rivers, swept down rapids, going over cliff sides, and they're not stunt props. It's not like it's a stuffed animal in a box. They use telephoto lenses to show you that cat is really in the goddamn box as it goes over the waterfall. So they were really making sure that people knew these were real animals in this movie. So the fact that it was a Japanese film, and that before it even came out, it faced scrutiny about animal welfare. And I don't want that to be the whole point of the show, but that was a point that was being made before the movie came out, and then our critics talk about it too. It's so interesting to me that a film like this was such a big mover in Japan and didn't do too shabby here. It made like $60 million in the States and really big on the VHS market. But you couldn't make a movie like this today. even if it was CG, no one would really want to go see it. So I think that is one of like the lost genres of film that we won't see anymore, are these animal adventure movies that don't really have any human characters, that don't really have celebrity voices. It's a narrator and really relies on the nature photography and the prompting of these cute animals to become marketable. And it's just something that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, even if we go back and look at the filmmaking, the editing isn't that great. The nature,
it
really isn't. I mean, when we get to that one scene where Milo is going off the cliff, it literally looks like this cat's being flung off a cliff, and it's just cut. It's horrible editing, and it almost brings a chill down your body to know the background after the fact that that cat was probably flung off a cliff. But nothing here really does the job of bringing us into this environment, because it's really focused on the animals. We get up close shots without the environment. We see Milo or Otis follow a different type of woodland creature, and there's nothing really that really engulf us into this. It really is intimate when it comes to focusing on Milo and Otis. And when we get to a narration of it, I don't even think that's that great when it comes to it. They're just describing what these animals are doing, not the environment. So I think if this was made today, the filmmaking process would have to be at top game to bring us out of it and have the stakes grow, because we have to see these animals in a bigger environment. Because right in this film, we just get them going through grass, we get them going through woods, and we don't really know where the setting really is. We go from winter to spring to fall, whatever it may be, but we don't appreciate the stakes that our animals are in. So to me, that is the biggest flaw to it, is it is a movie that asks the audience to fill in the blanks and just follow along with these animals. So it is a cutesy movie for probably about 7- for kids to be engulfed in it, and nothing more older than that.
No, I agree. Like, this is definitely something for kids that just aren't aware of the world yet, you know? And this is my first time watching it, understanding that there is it's a Japanese setting. This is Japan that they're shooting in. I was like, why is a crab in the middle of a farm? And why is there a lobster on a bridge by a river? Like, how close to the ocean are they? And then there's like the sea turtle later on as the tide rises. So, okay, they are near the ocean. I was just so thrown off by the geography. But yeah, that's the other thing too, is that when you're a kid, you don't notice the human hand literally under the dog, holding him slightly afloat so the turtle can grab him. And this time I saw it. So it was kind of like breaking the wizard behind the curtain, breaking the fourth wall, right? Of like, oh, I'm actually seeing the filmmaking happening. And talking about the editing, yeah, when you edit down 74 hours of animal footage, it's not all going to line up. And like you said, when the cat is in the waterfall, in the river, in the box, when they have the long telephoto lens, the rapids are moving, the box is shaking, but then it cuts to like a close-up of the cat, and he's chill in the box because it was probably shot on the other side of the river where it was calm, just to get that shot. It is challenging, especially for people that look at stuff like that in filmmaking. It's hard because, I mean, I didn't look at this as a critic, but when we look at what the critics say, how do you justify your critique of a film like this? It doesn't really follow any of the traditional narratives of filmmaking. It doesn't really have a script. I would say that most of the stuff with Dudley Moore is improvised. And the stuff that isn't, it does feel like you don't even need a movie. Close your eyes and he's reading you a story about a cuddly cat and a cute dog that get lost in the woods and then come back after they've like grown and had families and stuff like that. It is just a really interesting thing to see that this was actually marketed to people. Okay, so let's talk about, I don't know, the hard part for me about this movie is the idea that, like, I don't even know where I'm going to go with this. The challenging part of this movie for me is knowing that it was an hour and 15 minutes, yet it was so dull, so boring. And the things that were like supposed to be the dangerous, adventurous moments, the bear fight, right? Like, the bear fight barely lasts, and there's two of them. There is not enough action to keep you energized. It really is a sleepy time story. it almost reminds me of, like, I had this girlfriend who couldn't fall asleep unless she was listening to the Harry Potter books on tape, because the guy did the silly voices, but he had a smooth kind of soothing voice. I feel Dudley Moore's the same thing, right? Like, listening to Dudley Moore tell this story, I was like, all right, where's my blankie? I need to go to bed now. It's an hour and 15 minutes. I don't know. This might be a short episode because I really don't have much more to say about the movie.
This is hard because it's an hour and 15 minutes that plays like I spent 3 hours watching it. That's what it played out during my rewatch. But at the time, we got to look at it. How, as a critic, are you going to review this movie? It is absolutely difficult because you know what the audience is, what the filmmakers are intending the audience to be, and you can see the obvious flaws, but at the same time, it's intended for kids. So how do you make something that's so dull be so entertaining to kids? And you're going to have that sporadic editing. You're going to have the cutesy animals. You're going to have that intimate shots. So to me, this is a true test to the critic of that time. Is, are they going to put themselves in the shoes of kids? Or are they going to really tear this movie apart as adults? And I think we got more of the kid element that our critics really do contradict themselves to an extent, that we're not going to look at the kids piece of it because they do look at the adult piece of it. And they do get it wrong when it comes, there's no elements here that the filmmaking actually works, because it does look sloppy. It does look really kind of pieced together. So this is one that you have to put your mind with the kid. And it's one of those that it proved itself. This kids love this movie. We loved the movie at the time because we remember this movie. Milo and Otis is a staple to how we grew up because we remember not the situations per se, we remember Milo and Otis. I can't recall the situations that Milo and Otis were in within my last 20, 30 years before I last watched this movie, but I remember Milo and Otis. And that's the same memory as watching a cat video or a dog video that made me feel something during its 30-second watch on YouTube. That's the same effect that we get here. And to that extent, it was successful in what it intended to do.
I also think there might be some kind of like cultural difference in how the film was made and appreciated. So in Japan, they do have shorter films like this on a regular basis. They have films that are even shorter they show in the theaters. There's movies that are like 30, 40 minutes long. They're usually kind of like J-horror movies or gore movies or action movies. But they know that they can't stretch a certain idea to like a 90-minute runtime, so they'll show you two essentially short films, and that's very common and accepted there. This feels like that was kind of like in that realm, a very short movie that you can get in, get out, get on with your life, go work your 15-hour day before you go home to your kids kind of thing, right? And so, like I said, it doesn't translate well here for adults in the room, but kids liked it. The hour and 15-minute runtime, that must be standard there. But let's go ahead and do like apples and oranges to how movies like this are made here in the States. So, for example, like The Incredible Journey or Far From Home, let's even say Babe, let's say Adventures of the Yellow Dog, they all have human moments that they can cut back and forth because you've got essentially two storylines. You've got what's happening with the animals, and then back home, you've got what's going on with the humans, right? So there's not a monotony of cuteness. There's not a monotony of animal adventure. You get a kind of good combination of both, right? When we talked about our film Alaska a few weeks ago, we kind of said that there could have been more panda bear. And I think that's what it needed, not panda, polar bear. It needed more polar bear. Because if you bring in a cute animal, but you only put it in sporadically, well, you just want more animal.
100%. Even if it was an element where some of the shots that we get, we just see even human legs in the background in landscape to our animals, or even if we focus on, we have a fox scene of bearing food, if we focus even more on that fox of that situational piece, there are a lot of elements here that could have worked, that could have extended it 15, 20 minutes to actually say what's going to happen next with our animals. But again, we go from sea turtle to fox to snake, and nothing happens because we don't want to put these animals in peril. but our filmmakers are putting them in peril. It's unless they're falling off of a cliff or a waterfall, we can't have animal against animal because that's going to upset kids. And I think that's what really what we needed. And that's what teaches life lessons of nature. If we're going to go and have a movie that's going to have a cat and a dog with no explanation of having kittens and puppies, then we can have the elements of nature of the danger. Because it's almost like when we get to Milo in the tree with the snake, they might as well just kiss because all they're doing is looking at each other. So we needed an element here of danger to really kind of drive the stakes of and teach kids and not insult kids, teach them what nature is really like with these animals.
Yeah, and also the fact that that really happens quickly. An hour and 15 minutes, they go on an adventure and they are still technically puppy and kitten. And then they essentially meet their mates and have puppies and kittens of their own. I'm like, okay, I'm going to let it go because it's a kid's movie. And I know they are not trying to get too deep into the birds and the bees here, but it seemed a little rushed to me. And our critics also have a joke about that, too. I guess the last thing I'm going to say about The Adventures of Milo and Otis is I really put this on there as kind of like a litmus test of, A, what do the critics think? What do I think? But mostly, is this a movie that I really want to work into my children's repertoire of movies? So far, they're doing pretty good on things that I enjoyed as a kid and some new discoveries that are more contemporary. They got a good mix, right? I'm happy with what they've seen. My daughter right now is all about Kiki's Delivery Service. That's like her new favorite movie. Not a bad movie for a four-year-old to think is their favorite movie now. I'll take it. So is there room in the repertory for this movie? I don't think so. I don't think that this will benefit them in any way. I think that it will open a lot of questions that I don't want to answer about the animals in the movie or how the movie was made. My four-year-old's really smart. She wants to know everything. I feel like this is, it failed a nostalgia test for me. And it failed the test of, do I want to pass this on in like a cinematic legacy to my kids? It's not at that level for sure. But it was worth rewatching and reevaluating.
It was nice because I got a nice little nap eventually from it. But you know what? I think,
well, thank God you didn't have a bourbon with this movie. You wouldn't have made it.
I didn't need a bourbon with this movie to take a nap. But I think this one, I'm not going to reject it from kids because, you know what, I'll put it on mute and I love Dudley Moore. But you know what, this is going to be a just a narration of what's actually happening. And it's going to be a life lesson of this is what would actually happen to animals. And you can call me a bad parent, but you know what, there is a life lesson in nature that kids need to hear that the movie doesn't address. It's not all cutesy, and there is a result to animals that get lost in the wild. And
right. Like, that pug is dead versus that bear.
like you have the bear, and then you have Winter. You can stow away in a tree stump, but guess what? It's still Winter. So I don't know. I'm glad I saw it again. It brought back memories, but you know what? It also brought back memories that I don't remember a goddamn thing after the 30-minute mark as a kid, and I felt the same thing now. And it goes to the experiments of when you fall asleep to a movie when you're a kid, you kind of fall asleep to that point as an adult. And I think that's why I didn't remember the second half of the movie, is because I was asleep in that classroom.
Yeah, probably. The little carton of milk. All right, well, here's what our critics say about it. Gene brought this one to the episode.
Okay, our next film is a picture called The Adventures of Milo and Otis, a Japanese-made film about the cute relationship between a cute little kitten and an even cuter little dog. There are no people in this movie, just animals, and the voice of Dudley Moore, quite funny as the interpreter of the animal's thoughts. The cat Milo and the dog Otis first meet as infants on a farm. Of course, Otis does wind up saving little Milo, and they each become parents of more cute little fur balls. The real issue in evaluating this picture is just how much cuteness can you or your children handle in one movie. For me, even at only an hour and a quarter, I was restless during The Adventures of Milo and Otis, and if it hadn't been for Dudley Moore's fine narration, I would have been really restless.
Okay, so like generally, I do not watch the reviews before I watch the film. I watch the film first, and he really encapsulated exactly what I felt. Like, this is an over abundance of cuteness with not a lot of strong narrative. There's not a lot of, let's say, plot progression of highs and lows to keep you interested. it really is a jumbled mess of editing of animals doing stuff. And so that's where the restlessness comes in, where I had anxiety at one point of just like, something happened in this movie that makes me care, because right now I don't. It really is just these cut sequences of these animals progressing through meeting one cute animal after another, and then it's winter, and then they're a family, and then they're back to the farm, right? So yeah, I was getting restless, I was getting anxiety, and then I was nodding off from that. So he really did not say anything that I disagree with in that first review of the movie. It's exactly how I felt.
I think I do agree. I disagree with one thing, is Dudley Moore. And even though I love Dudley Moore, I think he wasn't contrasting enough with how he presented the dialogue. Because I think a good example would be, we have the scene with the frog. The frog, it all kind of just sounds alike, and it's just mere difference in tone. So I think it is a storybook read, like a tired dad reading a book to his kid. There's really nothing contrasting between the animal voices and Milo and Otis. So I think if you're going to drive a movie for an hour and 15 minutes with the visuals, the narrator plays a big part. So if you're feeling restless, you got to think, who's doing most of the talking? It's not all about the visuals. It is up to the narrator to bring that movie to life, if that's what you're going to bank on. So to me, I think Dudley Moore does a decent enough job on telling a lullaby, but not contrasting the characters enough.
Right. So if it was Robin Williams doing the narration, and everyone had a voice, and it was all different and crazy,
that's a party.
And there's a bunch of his, I'd watch that. 100%. Right? Like, where is that? All right. So here's the next part that gets a little controversial.
One more note, there has been a rumor going around that kittens were killed during the making of this movie. A rumor. According to the American Humane Society, however, that rumor cannot be confirmed as truth. Instead, the association statement about the film cites a number of positive endorsements of the movie from Japanese animals.
So I think it's a very weird thing to bring up in the review, because the studios send them the clips of these movies, whether or not they give it a positive score or a negative score. It's really based on what the movie is and what the movie delivers, right? I don't think that they would have appreciated the fact that they even mentioned this controversy in this episode. That's probably not what they signed up for. They already knew they had a big enough problem defending that in newspapers and magazines when a review show, a critic show that is talking about a movie and critiquing a movie brings up a thing like that, which almost seems like, I don't know, tabloid fodder. It feels a little bit disingenuous, like they shouldn't have done that. Because even if they gave the movie a thumbs up, which they didn't, that would dissuade the audience. So I felt there's like this weird kind of like gotcha or insincerity of bringing that part into the conversation rather than just tackling their review on the movie itself. It kind of reminded me of like the hyperbole that they threw in the Women in Danger slasher movie episode that we hated so much. There is some tabloid journalism there, and I feel that that's what that is. And if I was a studio that sent it to them, I wouldn't have appreciated that.
I'm back and forth on this one, and to an extent I agree, but on the other side of me, I'm looking at it of, how is this going to fare well? If we have a kid's movie, and the kid hears the rumors coming down, and you're going to have to explain yourself as a journalist saying you liked a movie hurt animals. You enjoyed a movie that you heard in a rumor that could sway your opinion. Because if it was factual at this point, and as we know now, it is pretty much factual. And I think that's why his opinion here is why he said it. Because when we have those rumors that kind of teeter to fact, and Gene in his reporting, unless he teeters to 98-99% factual, he won't say it. So we can tell that Gene holistically knows that this is what occurred, or else he wouldn't have said it. So I think that's important for parents to know before going in, to really prepare adults to talk to their kids if it were to come up, and be prepared. So I think I'm on both sides of the fence. You have to review the movie for what it is, and he did. He reviewed it to the extent of how it was made, how it made him feel, et cetera, et cetera. So, but it's the pre-warning I do appreciate him adding into his reporting for a film critic.
I just think it's an interesting place to do it. You know, like, why even review the movie if you had concerns about animal cruelty? I think that's something that, for example, they didn't review Silent Night, Deadly Night. They just wanted to talk about the controversy of people protesting it and that they were against this film without even really reviewing it. So I get that there should be some level of consistency of, like, are you a film critic or are you a tabloid journalist? But also this, let's talk about this episode really fast. We've already covered one of the movies that was on this episode, which is RoboCop 2, which they notoriously gave a thumbs down. The lineup was RoboCop 2, two thumbs down, Milo and Otis, two thumbs down, Betsy's Wedding, two thumbs down, Gremlins 2, two thumbs down. This was not a banner episode for those guys. And a lot of the movies on that list have had a huge reevaluation and reappreciation over the years. Gremlins 2 is on our list. We've already covered RoboCop 2. Who knows? We might cover all the movies that were on this particular episode. But for all those movies got two thumbs down, like, this one seems the most harsh because they brought the tabloid fodder into it. That's just my opinion.
I think this one was harsh because it has every right to be harsh. Because, again, when it comes to that entire lineup, this one, when it comes to the post-production, nothing really works here. Even the music, to an extent, it's just generic and it's just hypnotizing, mesmerizing, and it just is the lullaby aspect of it. So I think this one, I think they were a little bit too generous with, given especially the rumors that Gene presents to the table. I think this one, out of that lineup, just served a little bit more harsh reality because the filmmaking, again, is not good.
Well, what I need to do is I need to go back and watch the Japanese version because Ryoichi Sakamoto did the score for that one. And it's supposedly like a synth pop score behind this movie. And then they changed it for American audiences to be like this little whimsical, folksy banjo harp music, right? Which isn't bad, but I want to hear the Ryoichi Sakamoto music. I'm going to check that out, and I'll like do a report on the side. Anyway, Roger jumps in.
I think you're right on the money. It's an awfully, awfully cute film, and I think you're going to have to be an awfully, awfully little kid to really be fascinated by it. I can think of two movies like this, Benji the Hunter and The Bear, which both, you know, cut together footage of animals to make it look like a story, that are both much superior to this film. And as far as this film is concerned, I mean, in terms of the classic scenes that I'll remember when I finally hang up my hat as a film critic, I think the number one is going to be when little Milo gets married and his wife is going to have kittens and he's teaching her how to breathe using the Lamaze breathing method. And then she, I mean,
Ward does his best. It's what he is required to do. He does very well. It's hard to imagine somebody doing better. Yeah. I just think that, why couldn't they vary this a little bit more? I mean, it just, also I don't know that it was that beautiful either.
Once in a while, you know, if you're above the age of 6 or 7, you're thinking, how are they getting the animals to do this? And, for example, remember the scene where the three little puppies each climb up on top, first the first one, then the second one, then the third one, climb on top of the log. You can almost see the three of them being pushed up into position.
All right, so they're talking technical there, but I wish Gene would have finished his thought where it's not even that beautiful. He's 100% right. Like, if this movie, being a nature film, being a almost like pseudo-documentary, that's kind of how it feels, it's not shot very well. It really is a lot of cameras and, like I said, telephoto lenses keeping up with the animals. There aren't really a lot of good establishing shots of the environment. There aren't like beautiful sunsets or sunrises or sun clouds on the horizon. The movie literally is chasing these two animals around from environment to environment. And I feel that, yes, it's only an hour and 15 minutes long, but if you gave us, let's say, 10 minutes more of the majesticness, the majesty of the nature, of the world they live in, with some great music behind it, I mean, there's lots of great filmmakers like Malick and Ridley Scott that do that. They'll give you a 2-minute shot of a sunset, and it's beautiful, and it makes the movie. But this doesn't have anything like that. it really is like a dad with a camcorder chasing these animals around, just with nicer lenses.
There were so many moments here that I just said, please, for the love of God, pull the camera back and just give me one lingering note, not an ensemble, not just some bouncing music, just especially with the Winner scene. Winner demands a singular note, some mystery unison music that just goes with it. And all we get is the same old thing. We get the zoomed in shots, and there is a scene that's probably one of the most wasted scenes or wasted shots, is we get the Winner with the trees all lined up perfectly. And I just said, pull it back. Let me see everything in that environment, because that looks too perfect, but it's so beautiful. And we never get it. So I think it is absolutely wasted. And that would have added to a level of engagement to not just kids to see the cutesy stuff, but that adds something for the adult bringing their kids to this movie to really look at, to really engage themselves with. But I do love that both of them are having fun. And I love the fact that Roger is finding some humor out of what adults would see out of this film. But that's the only thing I think, and I feel bad for adults that took kids to this movie, because the only thing walking out is to kind of make fun of it as adults, because there is really nothing for adults to take out of this movie.
I mean, and that's the thing, is like, it's a two thumbs down from them, but it's not a mean review. They're not hating on it. This is one of the more neutral reviews where, like, you know what? Little kids might like it. There's some stuff for them to like, but I'm not going to recommend it. Thumbs down. Yeah, thumbs down. They don't have to attack the filmmaker. They don't have to attack the studio. It's a simple, I'm not a fan. And we didn't get as many of those as the notorious thumbs downs that we've covered, where they literally have to feel like the generations of filmmakers that made this movie are cursed because it was such a bad movie. Thumbs down. It's not that. It really is. It might be the gentlest thumbs down I've seen so far.
Not only that, but how many movies, how many dog movies does Roger give a thumbs down to? He usually is so lenient towards any movie surrounding pets or dogs. And that says justice to this kind of movie, because even Roger is making fun of the movie and saying, I can't recommend this dog movie. Name multiple that he has a cold heart when it comes to animals or pets, or more specifically, dog movies. He gave Air Bud, I think, a thumbs up.
He did, yeah. Well, and for context, the 2 minutes earlier, if you were watching this show, they were just tearing RoboCop 2 a new asshole, saying it was like the worst movie, the worst example of filmmaking. How dare there be a 12-year-old villain that kids are going to want to emulate? Like, they just were done ripping that movie apart. Now on to our next bad movie, Milo and Otis. It was cute, but thumbs down, right? So there might be a little bit of that in there too, understanding what their attitudes were 2 minutes before they start having this conversation. So yeah. Okay, so at the end of the day, I mean, I already said, this movie isn't recommendable for me. There is enough nostalgia warmth for me to go like, huh, that was cute as a kid, but I'm not hating on it. I'm not going to show it to my kids because I know they'll be bored as shit. So why even try? Why even bother? Why even rent it if it's renting anywhere? I don't know. I watched it on YouTube or something. So how do I feel about Gene's review? I got to say, I liked it. I liked that he had the same feelings that I did. I liked the fact that he was able to thumbs down this thing and not make it a hate crime against the filmmakers of how dare you make a movie this bad. No, it was a real, simple, eloquent, not for me, thumbs down. So for that, I kind of got to give him a B+, dude. Like, I kind of liked it.
You know, and with Roger, I wish he would have gone a little bit further. He turned this in kind of a joke review, but at the same time, I can't fault him for it, because finding a way to review this movie, it's hard for critics, but I do wish he would have gone to the kids will like it aspect that we've seen so many times with his review, saying this was intended for kids, because he's gone on the defense so many times that kids will like it. And there is a mention, but you know, he's spot on, and it was an entertaining review. I can't fault him for it. So, you know what? I enjoyed it. I have to give him a marginal 3 stars.
Yeah, 3 stars sounds good. No, like I'm really impressed by their restraint on this review. They did not show restraint to RoboCop. They did not show restraint to Betsy's Wedding, and they did not show restraint to Gremlins 2. The last movie on the list, I don't remember the name, but it's a James Toback movie I haven't seen. I'm kind of hot and cold on James Toback. I'll have to check that movie out, see if it's worth putting on the list. But yeah, like I think they were just in a mood. They knew what movies they had to cover. And if this was the, let's say, least offensive of the films that they were reviewing that they knew they were going to give thumbs down to, that might be the film's saving grace. All right. The Adventures of Milo and Otis. So we're kind of continuing with the animal theme. Next week, we're going to bring the show Far From Home, another 90s animal kid in peril movie. Haven't seen it since it came out. I recall it being better than Alaska. So let's see if that memory is correct. And then we'll go into more adult-themed, mature-themed, violent movies. We'll get out of the kid animal zone. But I'm glad that we swam in these waters for a minute to get the nostalgia out of the way, right?
We had to get some animal movies out of the way, and I'm glad we kind of just went on a little spurt. And you know what? Next week, I'm excited for, because that was a summer tradition during the 90s for me. So, but again, I haven't seen it in years, so we'll see if it still holds up or it's another Milo and Otis.
I guess we'll see. It's nice that this one is a lot easier to find. I had to dig for this one a little bit. I'm like, I don't want to spend a lot of money on Milo and Otis if I don't have to. I'd rather find it for free somewhere, and I did. All right, everyone. So thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Please rate, review, like, give us 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And please follow our YouTube channel. Give us a like, review us, let us know if there's anything you want us to cover, and share with your friends. Our Rob Reiner tribute is actually doing really well. People like it. They're responding. I think if we released it 2 weeks earlier, it would have had a little bit more momentum. We're a little bit behind. We record about a month out on these things. But yeah, there was some really kind words from some of the people that are watching it, and a handful of new subscribers too, because of the Rob Reiner episode. So let's see if Milo and Otis fans out there are going to give us a like and a review. I don't know. Anyway, thank you for watching. I'm Antonio. You can find me over at the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast at thecultworthy.com. You can find my co-host Justin Henson over at
themoviewire.com.
See you next week.
See you next week.